Case number 26, in Entangling Vines. One day, Xianyan Ji Xian was cutting weeds when he knocked a piece of tile against a bamboo. Hearing the sound, Xianyan was suddenly enlightened. He composed a verse. A single tuck, all prior knowledge forgotten. This is not the result of practice. Daily activities proclaim the ancient way, no more falling into passive stillness. Wherever I go, I leave no trace. In all situations, my actions are free. Everywhere, masters of the way speak of this as the highest function. So this koan, which is in the Japanese collection of koans, the Rinzai Japanese collection called Entangling Vines, is an old story from Chinese Zen history. And it's one that occurs to me and has been occurring to me over the past few days, partly because of the backstory, which I'll tell you in a few moments, of this guy. This guy who also brought us the koan, man up a tree and 3 pounds of flax, two koans on the all-time hit parade of at least this Ango, and certainly of centuries and centuries of people who've engaged with koans. And I've been thinking about him in particular because he's one of my favorite characters. I identify with him a lot in many ways. He has a similar spirit, I feel, to my spirit. I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing, but in any way, he's a person who I feel a sort of simpatico with. And also, Julie mentioned him yesterday in her Dharma talk yesterday morning on Man Up a Tree. And at first I thought, oh, well, that's it then. We all know that story, the bamboo, the talk, done, old, been there. But it continued to resonate with me all through the rest of the day, as it had been for a few days before Julie gave her talk. And last night I read this case and some of the background material on this man, and I dreamed about him all night. I had one of those nights when I was just sleeping very lightly, and sometimes I knew I was dreaming, and sometimes I just felt not completely descended into the deepest levels of sleep. And in all the dreams, he was here with us. He was sitting in this sendo. He was sitting with all the people who've come and gone through this Ango practice, this I have to admit, quite intensive version of a retreat. 3 weeks of starting at 6 in the morning, sitting throughout the day, hearing 2 or sometimes 3 Dharma talks a day, and having opportunities for Doksan 3 times a day, and finally ending more or less at 9. And then often there are meetings to have and all these things to do. It's a very busy and preoccupying time. And there was something really sweet about having Xianyan there with us because he was just like us. He was not, he was speaking English, and he was doing everything we were doing and sitting with us with a great faith in all the dreams. And he would sometimes speak up in a few of these dreams and say things to reassure us. I guess he was reassuring me that it's worth it. It's worth it to sit. It's worth it to devote oneself to this practice of silent sitting. And some of you know his story, and it's a kind of emblematic story. It's one of those stories that at least personally I've turned to for many years, just as an example of what we were touching into yesterday a little bit about our own efficacy, our own power, our own will to make things happen and to be good and to to somehow do the right thing consistently enough that that doing the right thing will open doors to us. Xianyan was a person who thought that was true, and I certainly have been, and sometimes when I get tired, am still a person who thinks that if I only do the right thing, then I think I've been disabused of this by 60 years of living, but you never know. There's always an opportunity for the old pattern of being good to sneak back in. So Xianyan was someone who was an eager student. He studied under two great Zen masters, Baijiang, who we know also from other koans and other stories in Zen. Baijiang's fox is one of the great koans. It was important to Wu Men. He placed it second in the Gateless Gate collection after the koan Mu. And Guishan, who we also hear about a lot. Guishan was the guy who kicked the water jug over, among many other interesting things that he did. So after he left Baijiang, he went to study with Guishan. I'm pretty sure, but I don't know for a fact. Actually, I have the book that says it right here, but I don't feel like looking it up right now, that Baijiang sent him away and thought he'd do better with Guishan, which is a kind of wonderful thing in itself. It's the kind of advice that feeds the idea that we could do better somewhere else, or that that if we heard the right word, or if we got the right direction, or it's sort of a cousin to trying to do the right thing, hearing the right teaching. And this was apparently prevalent in these days in China because people did wander around, and we've heard stories about that wandering a few times over the Yango so far. And it turns out that Xianyan was a great scholar, and Julie talked yesterday about how she related to him on that level, particularly being a great scholar herself and the author of many, many beautiful papers and texts and scholarly articles. And that was what he was like. But one day Guishan asked him the important question. So he said, "I don't ask what you've recorded from the scriptures and commentaries. I ask for a word from your original nature. Before you left the womb and before you knew east from west." So this original nature is at the bottom of everything that appears to happen in Zen. When we awaken to some truth, when our Dharma eye opens, it's not us opening the eye, it's not us waking up or becoming enlightened, it's the enlightenment, the awakened nature that's always been here the whole time, manifesting itself enough so that we feel it, so that we see it, so that we know it for ourselves. And it's not ours. It doesn't belong to us personally. It was here before our parents were born, before we came out of the womb, before we knew east from west, which is another way of saying, and there are other translations of Guishan's question, before we knew right from wrong, before we knew the world of duality, which is so useful to us in the modern world. Knowing duality is not a useless thing because, of course, as we say over and over again, it helps us drive our cars and pay our taxes and get dressed in the morning and come to the zenda, come to the temple. It's not a useless thing, but it's not the only thing. There's something bigger, something that encompasses the world of duality, this world of non-duality, the world of mu, the world of just this, the world of what's right in front of us. Not what we wish was right in front of us, not what we prefer, but what actually is here. To be able to face that without leaning back on what somebody else thought or somebody else is thinking. For me, when I was a young Zen student, this was a radical idea. I was so devoted to my first teacher. Every word out of his mouth I thought was important and directed specifically towards me. And it turned out that that actually wasn't the case, but again, that's another story. But the yearning I had to be directed was so strong, and the yearning to please, and the yearning to be good, so strong. You all know, or many of you know probably, the Mary Oliver poem, Wild Geese, that begins with the line, "You do not have to be good." The first time I heard that poem from my former boss at UMass, when he was teaching a retreat and giving a talk, Saki Santarelli, he paused at the end of that line, and I'd never heard the poem before. And again, because I was so eager to be instructed, I thought he was talking to me. "Melissa, you do not have to be good." And I was like, whoa, what? And the pause was long enough for it to make one of those little pivots that we talked about yesterday, and something opened. And then the second line of the poem, as you might know, is, "You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting," which was another description of the way I thought learning happened. So, of course, Mary Oliver then invites us into the world of what's right here, the world of the body, the world of the sound of the wild geese, the world of the breeze against our skin, not the world of imaginary things, although, of course, the poem does appeal to imagination in its final lines. But just this, and she says in that poem, "Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on." That's the other important line, the startling line. No matter what we think we're doing, no matter what we preoccupy ourselves with about our lives and our difficulties, it doesn't make any difference because the world goes on. And for me, Zen practice is about being in that world so fully that there's complete intimacy and no more separation. And what that means, of course, is that whatever arises is arising with me, or is actually, in a sense, me arising. As Shakyamuni Buddha is said to have said when he was born from his mother's side, he took a few steps and he said, "In heaven above and earth below, I am the only one." So that legend of his birth is pointing to this same teaching that everything is us. There's no separation, really. And it is our job as Zen practitioners to realize this, but not through our ideas, not through instruction, not through notes that we carefully take in order to continue to be good, but instead from our own knowing before we knew. Guishan says, "I don't ask what you've recorded from the scriptures and commentaries. I ask for a word from your original nature." And so Xiangyan took that instruction, and being a good boy, being a good Zen student, he kept trying to answer the question. He kept coming back to Guishan over and over and over again with answers. And Guishan kept rejecting him, kept saying, "No, that's not it. That's not from your original nature." And we know from other talks that this is a common theme or trope in these stories of being rejected and rejected. Sometimes, like in another story I told last week, being told, "You're not even worth rejecting. I spare you 60 blows. But the one who comes back, the one who keeps going, this is highly valued. I value it. I did it. in spite of a lot of craziness and difficulty, I just kept coming back, not to a person, not to a teacher in the end, but to the Dharma itself. When we chanted, "I take refuge in the Dharma," this morning during the liturgy service, my heart was touched by those simple lines. Where else would I go? Everything else has proved itself unreliable, but not the Dharma. Maybe the Dharma in some forms has proved itself to be unreliable, but not this essence nature, not the original nature. So finally, Xianyan was at the bottom of his strategies. He had reached bottom. He couldn't come up with anything anymore. And so he begged Guishan. He said, "Please, please." And we have to feel the utter sincerity of this, where he got to. He had used up all his tricks. There's another translation of his enlightenment poem. It says, instead of saying, this is not the result of practice, it says, this is not the result of any tricks of practice. I like that. And when we use up all our tricks, he asks him, please, for help, for an explanation. And Guishan says, "If I explained it, it would be no more than my own point of view. What benefit would that be in clarifying your mind's eye?" And this is really important. Zenkei Shibayama, I think it is. Oh no, it's Uchiyama Roshi, in his book Opening the Hand of Thought, talks about this one person cannot fart for another. It might seem a little rough, but I think it points to the actual fact. And we can't wake up for another. And we can't have another's insight. Our personalities, our history, creates a container that only we, even though we are the only one in the universe, also we're completely different and separate and unique. And so this oneness, this Dharma, this original nature comes through every person uniquely. And so anything that I say or do isn't yours. As Wu Men says, what comes in at the gate is not the family treasure. So we have to love Xianyan here because he doesn't give up and he decides that he hasn't read the sutras and commentaries thoroughly enough. So he goes back and he looks for more. And then finally he uses up even that, all the hard work of study, of learning, of copying out passages. It's fruitless. It's useless. He can't come up with anything that points out the way to him. So he says this famous comment, which David paraphrased the other day, "A picture of a rice cake doesn't satisfy hunger. Don't eat the menu." And so, in one of those dramatic moments that some of us are prone to, he threw out all of his books. And he vowed to live his life as a wandering monk. And one time I heard this story told orally, and I can't remember where I heard it. It might have been on a cassette tape, or maybe I read it somewhere, but it really stuck with me. He left the monastery and left Guishan in this hopeless state. And in his hopelessness, according to the story, I haven't been able to find a written source for it, but it still lives inside me. He sat on a rock outside of the monastery and didn't know what to do. And I love that moment. I've had moments like that. He didn't just say, "All right, I'm going to be a wandering monastic," and set out on the path. He set out on the path and then he stopped and sat down and really felt the hopelessness of the moment. He really felt what he'd left behind. And I myself have left things behind in my life, left behind people and circumstances that it turned out were toxic to me, were actually not worth hanging on to, even though I was always a very loyal person and would stay with things much longer than they were useful, stay with people much longer than they were nourishing to me. And so that pause, what am I doing? Is this the right thing? Is it really true that I should leave Guishan? That I should leave everything I've ever known, my books and my studies and my desire to be good and do it all right? That pause. And then in that moment, standing and noticing, and this is how I heard the story, that right near where he'd stopped was a graveyard. And it was the graveyard where an ancient teacher, a teacher from at least maybe 100 years or more back, had been buried, a guy that who was called the national teacher, Nanyang Huizhang. And so he stayed there. He felt that this was the place where he could live out the rest of his life caring for this grave. And I'm reminded of Diane's beautiful talk about sweeping. Just simply that hermit standing on his porch, sweep, 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 completely devoted to that ordinary activity. Now, somebody who had been trying so hard for so many years to get it right and do it right and read all the right things and be a learned person who remembered everything and knew the ins and outs of all the Buddhas and patriarchs and stories and sutras. Leaving all that behind to completely absorb himself in sweeping and caretaking. And then that moment. Everything left behind. No more trying. Just being. Being completely one with the doing of sweeping. And in that great surrender. The little sound of the tile he swept up hitting the bamboo. And this is how it can be. Dogen speaks very movingly of this moment, of the people who were awakened by a bamboo tile on, a ceramic tile on bamboo, or by seeing flowers, by seeing persimmon blossoms. That this is a possibility, but not seeking out these things in order to be awakened. There has to be that quality of surrender, of realizing that we cannot do this. But that if we surrender, if we touch our heads to the floor and raise our hands above our heads, that in that gesture we're embodying a very important part of this practice. We bring ourselves to sitting fully. We go through all kinds of stuff, some of us more than others, to even get here into the Zendo. It's a struggle no matter what. And then we sit, and then we surrender ourselves to the practice. The form is only a container, and yet it's also the whole thing. So, in this story, Guishan actually sends a disciple, Yangshan, to test Xianyan after he sends word back that he's had this great awakening experience, and there's a few more tests until he finally pleases Yangshan, who goes back to Guishan and reports, "Yep, Xiangyan really did come through. And then he later becomes a great teacher himself. And in his own life, there are many stories about him and his teachings. And if you think about the two that that I just mentioned, I think actually I was wrong about 3 pounds of flax. It's just man up a tree, maybe. But there's probably a few others as well. So this man up a tree, holding on for dear life, his teeth holding onto the branch, no place to rest. Because Xiangyan knew the importance of surrender, that colors the experience of being stuck. If we can surrender to being stuck, what does that feel like? If we can surrender to whatever is present now, great pain, great disappointment, if we can surrender to those things, we can also surrender to great joy. Not, as we say, the near enemy of joy, which is some idea of happiness, but the thing itself. The thing itself which can't be learned from books or from other people, which can only be learned from our own dedication and devotion and faith and doubt in this great way. Sweep, sweep. Sweep, sweep. Talk. Thank you. So we will release ourselves from the body of a fox, from our postures. Please be at ease if you can, and this is a time for questions, observations.
Even if you denied that you gave that talk just for me. Refused to believe
it. How did it speak to you, Chris?
I've always tried to be a very good boy. Work in spite of myself.
And I think, too, this one instruction for listening to Dharma talks is to listen as if you're the only person in the room, as if Melissa is speaking just to you. Because in this call and response, of course, she is. And I think as we practice, we can begin to receive what appears as the teaching. And then when we listen in this way, and of course, each one of us hears a different talk. If we all compared notes, well, what she said was... No, what she said was... but just honoring this practice of really listening. The whole universe is here for you, for each one of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And so, Xiangyan, when you were talking about him, when Julie mentioned him in her talk, you know, just all of his studies and all of his books and all of his human plans, and it's so touching to me personally, you know, that that he, after, you know, reaching his own wall, was able to, you know, drop that and see that it wasn't getting him anywhere, you know. Mm. But it was only until he could do that that he could hear the talk, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just such a difficult thing to do. But when you can, you know, even briefly, how lovely to hear the talk, you know, how much it just sings to us, you know, in the way that books and words and everything don't, and it's just, like, you know, yeah, so a great inspiration, you know, because so many, I think, of the other Zen characters, they're almost like, you know, died in the Dharma from, D-Y-E-D, died in the Dharma, you know, from birth. But here's some young, yeah, seems a lot more like us, you know, in 2014, you know. So I appreciate him as a guide.
Now, hearing that too, I realized that, no, you can't even do surrender.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
You have to just. What I like about his story, even, is this. He keeps trying to use what he knows, mm-hmm. just like we do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it's only when he finally, you know, just can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. Nobody would choose to surrender, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or I think we would choose, but we can't.
Oh, we can't, right.
Because there are lots of times I'm like, all right, all I need to do is surrender. Great. And then I really do my best effort to surrender.
And that's not, right?
And it's so frustrating, because I know, I've heard the instruction, surrender, surrender, surrender. But it really only happens when we really fail.
Mm.
When we truly, I went to this leadership training course, and one of the exercises they had us do was this maze, and the thing that you were supposed to get out of it, and it turned out the only way you could get out was by asking for help. So eventually I sort of figured it out, because other people seemed to be getting out, and so when I raised my hand, the person come, and I said, you know, will you help me? And he said, well, do you need help? And I said, no, but I've sort of figured out that's how. And he let me stay there. It wasn't good enough to know the answer, because I didn't really think I needed help. So that place of desperation where it's not a choice, he didn't think this was a good idea.
Mm-mm.
Like, okay, I know the strategy. But he was truly at the end of his rope.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing that's hit me about this entire anga, and for me at least, is that whole call and response thing. It's like the theme. You know, I missed the Daishin Dharani, or I did. And we've replaced it with this call and response. And at first I thought, oh, this is really hokey. And as time has gone on, all of the talks have seemed to circle back to it. That, you know, and the call seems like it could be almost anything. It's like, It can be sitting there devoting yourself to the sutras, to mathematics, to whatever, and you don't even know that it's a call, but it is. And you know, whatever it is you have, you kind of like throw yourself into, and it's a call to who knows what. And who knows what response comes back. Sometimes it's that talk that for each of us is, you know, directed right here. And just our sitting here is this sort of call asking for it.
Mm-hmm. was going to read a poem that he wrote that is the topic of the... I thought it was Three Pence Wax, but it's another koan. But and I just realized as you were talking, Ed, is another example of call and response. I won't read the whole thing, but the first two lines. I'll read the whole thing. What the heck? It's not that long. The chick pecks from within, the hen from without. The chick breaks free through the shell. When hen and chick are both gone, the function has not gone astray. Singing the same song, the mystical voice goes on alone. So I love that. It's, you know, it's the call, response, and then gone, but the song, they're singing the same song. And that's, I think, what we've encountered in call and response, that the call is the response and the response is the call. You know, and that seems mysterious.
And practical.
And practical. You have to go to the kitchen is calling me.
I hear a new koan, which awakened first, the chicken or the egg?
Just that the place you brought us to, this that sitting on the rock, is so like utterly out of plans, just stopped in his tracks. So this is, I guess we say it over and over, but not, I so want to have another plan. Right? this is not a matter about getting it. This is about really losing it. And I think certainly I know moments like that when I've been trying and I want to be a good Zen student and at some point it just breaks down and all my wonderful Zen tricks don't work anymore. And that they're the anguish of that, but some release of, I guess there's nothing to be done. So maybe I'll just go down to the Zendo and see.
I love that. As I sort of try to live into that moment from my own experience, there's that, screw it, I guess it's just not for me. Mm-hmm. That's like, okay, I'll just sweep this grave for the rest of my life. Right? either I don't deserve it, or I'm never going to stumble into it. But maybe it's a kind of near enemy, a sort of hopelessness.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, but it's a hopelessness with a little, like, it's still out there. I'm just never going to get it. Mm-hmm. Right? I'll just sweep this grave for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. But it opens, and maybe that's the gateway in some way, right? It provides that creative hopelessness, maybe, that sort of moment of pause that allows for the talk to get through, right? And then there's the surrender, right? And it's the quality of surrender that lets you float in water. Something holds you up, right? There's some sort of join.
And the falling back into the arms of the Dharma, or the water, the person.
Yeah.
Your words of leaving places and leaving people also really spoke to me. For obvious reasons. And just that feeling of, like, I don't know what comes next, but it's not any more of this. Mm-hmm. So that feeling of sitting on the rock was also extremely familiar. Yeah. It's hard to overcome that loyalty that you spoke of. Mm-hmm. But I guess that's part of being a good boy.
Yeah? Yeah, I think so.
And, we're sort of taught to accept and embrace all things, and it's easy to think that my unhappiness is somewhat one of the things I have to just, you know, well, that's just my dharma or something like that. And so how to know when that's not true anymore or ever? I don't know.
Yeah, it's so complex, you know, as you're talking, Chris, and what you said, James, it made me recall when I left my professional life. I had two, I don't know, energetic pushes for it. I don't really know how to talk about it. This is like a new feeling. And I was working with a coach at the time who kept pointing out that one of them was not true. she kept saying over and over again, you know, that's not, you know, so that, and part of it was, as I sat on the rock, I thought, well, this is just isn't for me. You know, it's not my dharma to be speaking to 1,000 people in a big conference hall, and you know that I just can't put up with all the other things that accompany it. But she kept insisting that I was actually moving towards something else, this thing that we're sitting in right now, and I had to continually, you know, sitting on my rock, the two things were almost battling each other. And the first one, if I had seen through it as the delusion it was, could have kept me there. And in fact, it did. You know, I kept saying, "No, I can put up with it. Come on. How can you say this is not for you? I'll just grit my teeth.
Just practice.
I'll practice. This is practice. Yeah, yeah. I'm a Zen practitioner. Right. I can put up with anything." But then the actual surrender, you know, when I actually left, which, because I'm so loyal, it took a really long time, and I have these little moments of sitting here, and you know, there's not a bamboo tile on bamboo, but there's like, oh, this was what it was for. This is why. It's not anything I could have figured out. You know, so it's like the bird singing, and it's like the siren going by in the street, and just the capacity to sit on a cushion in the middle of all that. It's very. There's a lot of near enemies in here.
Can you spell what you mean by that a little more? Near enemy.
Yeah.
You said it, James, or I don't know.
I said it, but anybody, you want to talk about near enemies? No, David won't talk about it. James, you know. Thank God.
I'll take a run at it. My experience of it is they're like these foyers, right? Like they're on the way somewhere, but they feel like oh, this is it. So like I was saying, a sort of hopelessness that can feel like, well, maybe this is what surrender is, right? And you get attached to that, right? As this, you know, okay, it's flavorless and gross, right? But maybe this is what practice was all about. And it's just close enough, right, to really keep you convinced for a while.
Mm. Right. Yeah, thank you. That's really clear.
So along that line, what had just come up for me is this thing, you know, Joe Kobeck talks about no hope, and how, you know, that isn't exactly the same thing as being hopeless, or, you know, and I was trying to figure out, so, you know, what's the difference here energetically, you know, so there's this, it's not really resignation, I think that's the difference, right? That if you say, well, so this is just how it is, and you know, it's just going to be this way, and this is it and all it ever will be, right? So that's being hopeless. And this idea of no hope is actually, there's still this calling out, I think, like, oh my God, you know,
I have no hope of solving this on my own, but I so desperately, you know, want it to be solved. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, really being honest about the situation as, you know, I just can't do this. And calling out from that place of, holy shit, I just really can't do this. But I so want something, you know.
Yeah.
It's, maybe it's the wanting, you know, rather than just the giving up. You know, it's this wanting to. And if you call out, you know, from that wanting, that I can't do it. That's where the miracle can happen. There can be such great transformation in that moment.
Right.
You know, and it's very mysterious. It's so mysterious how people, you know, in identical situations, you know, it one person, you know, it works for, you know, reaches that spot and there's an opening, and other people don't quite, you know, there's some just miss somehow. And
you know, for me, it's there's the kind of hope that's the near enemy of the kind of hope you're talking about. Going back to using near enemy, is that we have the capacity to know what could happen, right? So in our hoping, we're actually fantasizing some outcome that that looks from this vantage point better than where we are. And so, you know, so I always think about T.S. Eliot's line, live without hope, because hope would be hope for the wrong thing.
Right.
So he's not saying live in despair,
right,
but he's saying just realize that there's no way to know what's going to happen. It's absolutely impossible. We can base things on statistics. We can kind of figure out, oh, this will probably happen. But we don't really know. And we don't know what awakening feels like. We don't know what surrender feels like. But our mind thinks it knows, and that's the part that's hoping. And yeah. And then you know, we were talking about Job the other day, right? And Stephen Mitchell's translation, when God comes out of the whirlwind, the first line that he says to Job is, "Look, hope is a lie." You know, that's such a great, like, wallop. You know, to forget about all these things you're trying to figure out here. He's also talking about surrender, this kind of true surrender, which nobody else can do. And this is what we're practicing here. You know, it's not knowing; it's hope in the face of not knowing. Right?
And this. Oh, the two kinds of hopelessness you mentioned. For me, as I was listening, what clarified is that when I totally identify with the hopelessness, then I very subtly perpetuate it. So I am the hopeless one. I don't deserve anything. I'm an idiot. And I'm so close to it that it feels terrible and good in some way. It's like, all right, well, at least I know the truth. The journey's over. God damn it, I knew it all the time. And there's a real, all right, this is the worst place, but at least it's firm ground to stand on. And, you know, I run it up the flag and I salute it. And it, boy, it just appears like that. It appears like, yeah, all that other stuff is just, that's not true. This is true. And so that's the actually not too helpful. I mean, we all go there, and I have to spend a lot of time there sometimes. But there's this other place that is actually, and there's some unconscious part of that. It's unconscious, it goes around. But there's this other kind of despair, which is sitting upright in the middle of despair. There's some not knowing that I may, for me it's, okay, I'm a total idiot, but it's all I've got, and I'm going to make my home here. Mm-hmm. I don't have a better person to be, but there is that that yearning or that, you know, it's that sweeping, all right, I'm going to be stuck in this koan forever.
Right.
Right, but there's something, there's, and it totally changes. Then in that something, I walk into my life and I pray. But without, you know, that sense of, oh, well, if I pray, it'll be this or that. But I really make my home here. And then I am taught and I am done in and I am cooked by the thing that was the problem. Then, you know, dissolves me so that I can, so something new can come, so I can be reborn. But there's no faking it. He said that the wheel of the Dharma grinds exceedingly fine.
Yeah. You don't get to keep.
Can't I take a little bit?
Come on.
But wow, so helpful, this near enemy.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Thank you for asking. Yeah.
It seems to me, as you go through life, there are lots of rocks. I left so many situations behind, and every time I set them up and I don't know what to do,
yeah.
So I go on a new path and then something else happens.
Yeah.
And then this act of surrendering happens over and over again. It's not just one time.
No.
You think you're done with it, and then something else happens. And you're like, oh my god, everything's upside down.
Yeah.
You know. You don't know.
I really hear you. Yeah.
So there are lots of rocks.
Yeah. Lots of rocks.
Lots of rocks.
Rocks everywhere.
There's rocks everywhere. Well, and you know, too, the sitting on the rock is a nice description of Zen practice.
Yeah.
Especially
what it feels like.
10 days. It's like, oh my god, I'm just sitting here for, yeah, 400 million hours. So, but this pausing that we've been also talking about, you know, just really stopping and not trying to figure anything out, but kind of making our home in the stopping.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good description of what we're doing.
It seems like every time I sat on a rock, I have been calling out for help, and I've been very fortunate every time there's some response.
Yeah.
And coming to this angle, this whole thing has been a response for me. It's just wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful to be here.
Me too.
What comes up for me in what you're saying and the way that you're saying it, right, is the like standing in the midst of water crying out in thirst, right? You know, or sitting on this rock,
right.
Hopeless, right? Like, oh, you know, I know there's water out there, but I'll never
find it. Because of who I am.
Yeah, because I blew it in some fundamental way. My bad karma.
No water for me.
And then the something else, you know, in that moment, like even in that moment, something else is already showing up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's the other side of practice. So it's, to clarify, it's not just sitting on the rock, but it's receiving. It's really becoming a receiver of what the world is offering, which is constant. Yeah, Chris.
Well, I think also in the talk and just with that story, is there's a quality of stopping and of surrender and no longer trying to learn the way he was learning through books and through going and, you know, conversing and doing Dokusan with his teacher. And he just stops, but he stops in a different place. Mm. He leaves the Zendo and he walks somewhere not really knowing where he's going to go, and stops when it feels appropriate, but it's something different. It's a shift in some different direction, and it's sitting in a different place from where he is.
That's a great point.
Yeah. Well, I love that we have to set out and we can't know where we're going. So but that the necessity of setting out, and
we have to get up and move. It's not just about
right.
just being with things.
Yeah.
You've got to do something different. Don't know what that is.
Right.
Mm. So, yes.
Story that you started with about the person who just goes through life and doesn't like really leave a trace behind. And it makes me think of the, you know, when you're camping, people are supposed to leave a trace behind. And I like that notion, but it seems really, really, for me, very difficult because I feel that I create turbulence no matter what. And I don't... I appreciated hearing that message from the God, but at the same time, it seems so unattainable.
Yeah. And you write from the poem that he says after he gives the talk.
I think it's also, of course, all of us leave a trail of disturbance wherever we go. And I think this leaving no trace, how I hear it, is being completely where we are. So it's not about that something doesn't happen when we go somewhere, but that that we complete the activity. So we go somewhere and we receive what we need to receive and we give what we have to give. And then when we leave that. Because I know some situations I go in and then I carry it with me. Like, oh, I should have, or they should have. And to me, that's the kind of trace, like of wishing I had behaved differently or something in there, and then I carry a kind of regret or sometimes a resentment, you know. And I think this leaving no trace is being fully present in whatever interaction, being there wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. And then when we leave, we're wholehearted in our leaving. And then, for me, it's having faith that my disturbance is part of the gift for other people. I mean, not that that my needs... I grew up thinking that my needs were bad, and the best thing I could do is not ask anyone for anything or need anything. But realizing that even my limitations in the place, well, you know, where I genuinely have to ask people, you know, will you run the timing for the next day because I can't be here or something. But to come forward with that. And so trust that even though I can't know what my impact on the world is, that my prayer is that it's positive. And that's hard for me. I can believe that where I'm good. Oh, well, I said some nice things. But where I get lost, and that even my lostness could be a gift to the world. So there's a kind of, for me, a prayer and a hope that since I can't know what my impact is, that I pray that it might be of use to people, even when I disturb them.
And
does that...
Thank you. I mean, these fellows writing this no trace stuff all left traces, like the poem about no trace.
Exactly, right.
So it's not all bad.
Well, right, and you know, I was just looking at the different translations of the verses because they both talk about not leaving a trace. But Yangshan, who Guishan sends to test him, doesn't buy that poem. They say, like, that poem is not okay. Mm. It's not really recognizing that, of course, you leave a trace. You know, and so he has to do another poem, and then he doesn't like that one. And then he has to do another poem, and finally says, okay, you got it. And that last poem, it's about seeing it as it is what I've learned, something like that. And so that the seeing it, you do see that everything is part of this thing. There are traces being left. And also, there's some completeness in it. The embrace of the trace. The trace embrace. As they say.
Yeah.
So it's, and the mind keeps going, leave no trace. It's dualistic. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just one side. You named, and you elucidated the other side, which is, of course, we leave traces. And may they be not less harm than more harm.
I went to summer camp when I was younger and did a lot of hiking. And so we talked a lot about leaving a trace in terms of ethics for the wilderness. But one of the spins this camp put on leaving a trace, I think, which really ties to kind of what David was saying, is really try to leave things better.
Yeah.
So not just going out into the wilderness to leave no trace, but really try to leave the campsite or wherever you are a little bit better, if you can. Mm-hmm. Whatever that is.
Yeah. So if you're going to make a disturbance, make it a disturbance in the direction of better.
Yeah, positive something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, an ape. Maybe.
I was just going to kind of bring it back to the idea of being a good boy. Yeah, sort of thinking about that, it's funny because I think about that and I feel like with myself it's the exact opposite. Like I'm constantly rebelling. I'm constantly trying to overturn something. It's like, stop. Is this the right thing?
And that's that wonderful uniqueness, you know. And Guishan, Xianyan's teacher, was more like you. You know, when he was tested, and everybody was trying to come up with these great things about this, his teacher put a water jug in front of everybody and said, "Say a word of Zen about the water jug." And you know, one guy says, "Well, it's not a wooden sandal." and Guishan goes right up to it and knocks it over and walks away. Right? So that both spirits are important. You have to have the bad boy, good boy. Yeah, but you don't want to be stuck in either one. And Guishan became also a great, great Zen master. But he was a little rough around the edges then.
And I think it's about really seeing whatever our particular strategy is for manipulating the world.
That's really
it. Some of us, like you, we're going to make my way. You're going to know I'm around. I'm not standing for the, you know, and we endlessly repeat it, expecting some different result. And some of us are good. So I love you bringing in, it's not the particular thing, but knowing, beginning to be a little street smart about what we're doing, about our particular racket.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, good girls and boys sometimes become bad girls and boys as a reaction to that, and bad boys and girls sometimes become good boys and girls as a reaction. And I mean, I can think in my own life of flipping back and forth between those two stances, and they're both prisons. So, with that, I get to sit on a rock.